This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time.
My guest is the field biologist Tor Hansen, speaking with us today about the evolution of birds and the natural history of feathers. In your book, Tor, you say that our modern technologists and engineers regard feathers as an aerodynamic wonder. They silence the flight of owls, give shimmer to hummingbirds, keep penguins dry below the ice. But in addition to the services they perform for birds, feathers have been put to use as religious symbols and fly fishing lures, as fashion statements and writing instruments, as warm sleeping bags and golf balls. Is it true that they derive from dinosaurs?
All of the best information we have now is really making that story pretty strong, Lewis. There is a trove of feathered fossils now coming out of northeastern China, dating back 110, 130, even 160 million years. And they're all showing up, the feathers are showing up in a certain line of dinosaurs, the theropods, which were the meat-eating dinosaurs, including such famous ones as Tyrannosaurus rex and the velociraptors that were so diabolical in Jurassic Park. So that line of dinosaurs seems to display several kinds of feathers, displaying all of the steps in the evolution of feathers, from simple quills to filaments and fuzz to the increasingly complex barbs and barbules of a modern feather vane.
What use would a dinosaur have for feathers?
This is an excellent question. There have been arguments dating back for, 150 years at least over what the first use of feathers may have been. And this evolution in steps from a simple quill up through fuzz and other steps towards a modern vane suggests that those first feathers may have been used for something like display. And in fact, we're now able to get true colors of some of those ancient dinosaur feathers. What people are doing is taking pictures with an electron microscope from the fossils themselves and looking for patterns of cells called melanosomes, which are pigment cells, essentially, in those ancient fossils, and then matching up those pictures with pictures taken of modern feathers and the pattern of melanosomes there. And it's now possible to say that certain dinosaurs had a fiery red crest and black and white wings, or that they were ginger-colored from stem to stern.
Did dinosaurs fly?
Did dinosaurs fly? Well, now this is a question that paleontologists would return with a question, and they might say, well, of course the dinosaurs flew, and they're called birds. It gets down to trying to distinguish when birds actually became what we think of as birds versus dinosaurs. It looks as if they evolved straight out of this theropod lineage and at some point developed the ability to fly. And it's a real question and a bit arbitrary when you call a bird a bird.
We will settle on any date you care to mention, and now we have birds, and feathers are nature's masterpiece. Give us some reasons as to why the feather is such a magnificent work of art.
Well, what's really amazing about feathers is the diversity of form and function that you see in nature. There are a great number of things that are beautifully adapted to a single purpose. For example, the eye is so beautifully adapted for vision. But there are very few things in nature that are adapted to so many purposes as feathers. And you have feathers that are incredibly effective insulation. The down feather is still the most effective insulation we've ever discovered. Then you have feathers, contour feathers, that are perfectly waterproof, structurally waterproof. So even if you scrape off all of the preen oils, it's simply the structure of the vane of the feather that is waterproof. And of course, you have feathers beautifully adapted for flight and feathers beautifully adapted for the colorful displays in birds. So this great diversity of form leads to a great diversity of function in feathers.
How many feathers does a bird carry around with it?
Good question. Well, so part of this book, I decided I needed to answer that question, and so I took a very small bird, the winter wren, and plucked one of those and counted the feathers, and it quickly got up to around 2,000 feathers. And if you were to pluck A tundra swan, for example, you might find 25,000 feathers on that single bird.
And these all renew themselves. I mean, don't birds go through periods of molting when they change their feathers?
Absolutely. Birds molt for several reasons. Some birds will molt seasonally to exchange drab plumage for their beautiful mating plumes and then lose the mating plumes and replace those again at the end of the mating season. In other cases, birds molt simply to replace plumes, either feathers that have been damaged or feathers that are wearing out, because they do wear out over time and they are degraded by parasites and things. So the way a bird renews its plumage is simply to grow new feathers, pushing out the old ones and the new ones growing in behind.
Similar to the way in which a snake renews its skin.
Yes, although a snake will shed the skin in one go, whereas feathers, being so numerous, can be shed in series or so you're never bare, so to speak.
Let's talk about function. First, as a insulating material, give us some of the spectacular examples that you mention in your book.
Well, the insulative quality of feathers is truly dramatic. The bird that I feature in the book is another songbird, a small songbird, the smallest one to really survive the cold of the boreal winters in North America. And it's the golden-crowned kinglet. And it's a tiny, tiny bird. Its body, if you strip the feathers off, would be about the size of your thumb. And that bird, with its downy plumage, can maintain its body heat at a very high rate, even on a cold, cold day. So you might have the difference in temperature between inside that feathery coat and the outside of more than 140 degrees Fahrenheit.
And out of down feathers, we still can make the best of sleeping bags and down parkas to keep ourselves warm.
Absolutely. And that, to me, is one of the more fascinating things I've learned in this project. And, you know, I came at it from the standpoint of a biologist familiar with the uses of feathers in nature. But it's been astounding to see how many ways that people have co-opted feathers for their own uses. And of course, the down qualities of feathers are used to this day in a wide variety of pillows and sleeping bags and down comforters, because they're still the most effective insulation that we know of.
But those are feathers primarily from ducks and geese?
Yes, the down that you buy commercially are from ducks and geese, and most of those ducks and geese are from places where they feature in the diet. So these are byproducts of the duck and geese poultry industry in places like China, where they're common menu items. And so those feathers then are shipped out and processed and cleaned and stuffed into our pillows here in North America.
How large an industry is that in terms of money? Do you have any idea?
It's more than a $1 billion industry. It's quite a large industry, and it's one that's somewhat fascinating in that in most industries, the demand for the product is directly related to supply. But in the feather down industry, the supply is determined by how much meat is being eaten, how much duck and goose meat is being eaten primarily in Asia. And so there's a disjoint between the supply side and the demand for feather down. It's quite an interesting industry that way.
You mentioned penguins. How do penguins keep themselves warm in the water below the ice?
The penguins are a marvelous story in that they're diving into water that is actually below freezing, because it's so salty that the water can be 30 or even 29 degrees below that Antarctic ice sheet. And so the penguins have several strategies. They have a beautifully waterproof coat of feathers. Not a drop gets through. They have insulating down, and then the penguins also have an insulating layer of blubber as well. So a 3 layers of protection for the penguins.
Can feathers also serve to keep birds cool?
A great point. So you have this wonderful insulation. What do you do on a sunny day? Or what do you do when you start to fly and you start generating all of this incredible body heat? So birds do have the ability to control their feathers individually with muscles. Each feather follicle is surrounded, the base of the feather is in a follicle surrounded by muscles. So they can lift those feathers and to release body heat. And then they've also developed a very complex system for breathing that not only brings them oxygen but also allows them to expel body heat, because you can't, as a bird, simply dispel it easily through all of this insulating plumage. So they breathe in an almost circular fashion, a four-step process that brings the air into their body cavity, into great air sacs that even reach inside the bones and effectively shunt the heat out when they breathe out.
Let us now talk about the aerodynamics of flight and the wing as an airfoil. You mention Leonardo da Vinci, you mention the Wright brothers carefully observing birds in flight, and I gather that we are still, even now, learning about aircraft design from our study of birds.
Yes, there's been a long history, even back to mythology, of mimicking birds in our dreams and in our practical abilities for flying. And even now, if you look out at an aircraft wing, you can see things that were inspired by birds. The really amazing thing about how a bird wing functions is that they function not only as a single unit, the feathers working in concert to create an airfoil, but the individual flight feathers are also beautifully shaped as airfoils, with a curved upper surface and a rachis, the central part of the feather that's offset, and they're beautiful individual airfoils. So you essentially have an airfoil made up of more airfoils. And if you watch a bird fly carefully, you'll see how it spreads those flight feathers, adjusting them constantly to any change in air pressure or wind speed so that they can manage the airflow around their wings in a way that is incredibly efficient and continues to inspire aeronautical engineers who would like to increase the efficiency of our fixed-wing modern aircraft. So then the next time you're flying, if you look out the wing, many jets now will have an upturned end of the wing. You look far out on the wing and there's a little fin out there. And that fin is inspired by the way birds will splay their outer wing feathers, again, to control the turbulence of the air and make their flight more efficient.
And you also say that maybe in the not-too-distant future we'll see little quill bristles on the wings of airplanes, also serving as airfoils.
This is something that people are experimenting with right now, and that is sort of the idea of a fuzzy wing, in that birds, you know, can lift individual feathers, again, to control the turbulence and micro-turbulence around the wings and make them more efficient. And there are experiments suggesting that a fuzzy aircraft wing could mimic bird feathers in that way and increase the efficiency of the plane.
Let's now talk about feathers as religious symbol or artistic symbol, and then as fashion statement.
The close association of feathers with flight and with the skies has really given them many, many a star turn in our mythologies and even in our religions. If you look to ancient Egypt, you learn that at death, a human soul was weighed against the weight of a feather. It was measured against the weight of a feather by Anubis, the jackal-headed god, weighed every human soul. And when the weights were in balance, then that soul, that person, individual, would be invited into the eternal kingdom of Osiris. But when the scales tipped wrong, then the soul would be fed to this slavering hippo, lion, crocodile beast that lurked at his feet. And you can look at many other cultures in history, or even modern day, in places like the Amazon, where feather adornments distinguish a person in life, but can be even more important in the afterlife when they determine the fate of the soul. A poorly adorned soul at death in the Waorani tribe, again, that soul will be cast from heaven to be devoured, but in this case by worms and not by a lion crocodile beast.
In our Christian hierarchy, our angels are feathered creatures.
They are feathered creatures. And what's interesting, too, is if you look among the monotheistic faiths, whether it's Christianity or Judaism or Islam, even Zoroastrianism, they agree in their depictions of angels. They're invariably in human form, but with feathers added to symbolize this elevated angelic state. And it's the feathers that are diagnostic. If you look at descriptions of demons or the devil, they invariably have leathery, bat-like wings, where the feathers are closely associated with the angels.
And in the Middle Ages, they were sold as relics at great price for a feather that had fallen from the wing of the Archangel Gabriel.
Absolutely. Feathers have been valuable as religious symbols and perhaps even more valuable in the fashion trade, you know, over the centuries. This idea that people have co-opted from birds, where plumes, the colorful plumage, is used to allure and beguile. Well, we do the very same thing, and we have from very early days in multiple cultures where feathers were used to adorn. And one of the more interesting peaks of that whole process was in the late 1800s and just past the turn of the century, when feathered hats spawned a massive international industry. That fashion was a dominant force for birds of many kinds. The slaughter of wild birds for the feathered fashion trade really inspired the first conservation movement in America and led directly to the founding of the Audubon Society. If you look upon the modern-day symbol of the Audubon Society, it's the great egret, and you can see its plumes trailing out behind. Well, the egret was almost eradicated in the frenzy to adorn women's hats.
So, and it was a very expensive adornment. In the 1890s, you would have seen fashionable women, the Astor 400, wearing egret plumes, and they would cost how much?
They were extremely expensive, both egret plumes, birds of paradise plumes, various birds, even whole birds who appeared on hats, and ostrich plumes were also very expensive. Ostrich particularly so because they were considered fashionable year-round. So a really fine ostrich plume hat was something you could wear in any season. And it so happens that when the Titanic went down in 1912, the most expensive cargo on the ship's register were cases and cases of fine ostrich plumes destined for the hat makers of New York. And they were valued in today's money, they were valued in the millions of dollars.
Feathers have gone out of style in New York, but they're still in style in Las Vegas.
They're in style in Las Vegas, and I have to say, too, that this is very recent stuff, but they're coming back into style in a broader way. And all you have to do to see it is turn on the latest episode of American Idol, where you can see the judge and rock and roll icon Steven Tyler wearing rooster feathers woven into his hair and on great earrings. And this has spawned the latest manifestation of this ancient tradition, this new feathery fashion craze that is one that has fly fishermen up in arms, because those are the feathers that typically fly fishermen would be using to hand tie flies. But they're all going to the fashion trade now. A full cape of rooster hackle that used to sell for $150 is now more than $1,000 if you could even find one to buy.
And what about the headdresses on the girls in Las Vegas?
Well, this was a grand adventure for me. You know, as a biologist, I've made a lot of trips to places like tropical rainforests, but I've never before traveled on a research trip to Las Vegas. And in this case, I did so to interview the costume designers and also the showgirls about their feathered costumes, which are ornate and elaborate and can contain thousands of feathers. And with the rhinestones and everything else on them, they might weigh 20 or 30 pounds.
One last word, Tor, about the feather as the quill pen.
This has to do with a fundamental structure of the feather, which is the tube. Feathers grow as a tube, and then they unfurl to make these shapes that we're so familiar with. But if you look at the base of any feather, you will see that that tube is still intact in the quill portion of the feather. And that, of course, made for a wonderful writing instrument from the Middle Ages through the mid of the 19th century. Those quill pens really penned every document one can think of during that period. They were a wonderful, wonderful writing instrument. And in fact, the name pen derives from the Latin penna for feather.
Did you write any part of your book with a quill?
I had great aspirations to write a chapter about quill pens with a quill, and I got goose feathers from a neighbor who keeps geese and carved quill pens, and quickly realized that it was a skill that was going to take a lot of practice. I'm still working on being able to write my name with a quill pen without leaving splotches of ink, but certainly when you get the knack of it, a lot of things have been written with quills.
Among them, the Declaration of Independence.
The Magna Carta, the novels of Jane Austen, almost anything you can think of between about AD 600 and certainly the 17th and 18th and into the 19th centuries.
Thank you, Tor Hansen, for speaking with us today about the natural history of feathers. I'm Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News, copyright Bloomberg 2011.